This is the Book Riot Podcast, a weekly news and talk show about what's new, cool, and worth talking about in the world of books and reading. This is episode 44, and we're recording on Friday, March 14th, 2014. I'm Jeff O'Neill, and I'm here with Rebecca Shinsky, and we're the editors of BookRiot.com. Rebecca, here we go. We're back.
Good morning. Yes, we are back. It is Pi Day.
Oh, this, yeah, it is. It is.
It is.
Which is, I guess, an excuse to make puns about baked goods, as far as I can tell.
Yeah, nobody brought me any pie this morning. But there's still time. Richmond does have a restaurant that only serves pie. It's called Proper Pie, and it is amazing. And
Well, in the meantime, you can just do some geometry, because that's the other, I mean, that's the other, that's just as satisfying as a nice big cherry pie.
That's not nearly as delicious. Pie is so much better than geometry. And I think maybe this is like my inner Leslie Knope of pie coming out. So that's where I am this morning.
That's, I know. Now you know how I feel every day that I should be eating pie right now.
Just an
eternal
deep
sadness that
and
I'm not.
Unsatisfiable longing for pie. Yeah. We got some follow-up from listeners.
It.
You want to do that? So Shannon from River City Reading here in my fair city of Richmond, when we talked about reading stats over the last couple of weeks, suggested that we check out a service called Literally, which you can find at literally.io, and we'll drop that into the show notes. But it's an app where you can track your reading. You can put in what books you're reading, how many pages they have, all sorts of super nerdy data collection stuff. Looks like you do have to enter it yourself. So if that's a thing that you are interested in doing, it's not automated, but a cool way to just, you know, check out and collect info about your reading life and maybe start paying attention to what the trends are. Mm-hmm. Like if you read more on the weekends than you do on the weekdays, how many average pages per sitting you have, that sort of thing. Definitely worth looking at. So thanks, Shannon, for telling us about that.
Very cool.
Last week when we were talking about the smartwatch with the app that flashes one word at a time to ramp up your words per minute and make you a speed reader, you and I sort of both started dreaming about what else these watches could do. And one of those was a cooking app that might read to you as you were cooking, and you could say forward or back or like tell it how to progress the recipes as it instructed you in the kitchen. And it turns out that this thing exists already.
What?
The future.
It's the future, Jeff. And we didn't even know it.
It is so the future. It's great. Aaron Riley let me know on Twitter that the Jamie Oliver Recipes app does these things. And so I downloaded it to my iPad mini. The app is free, and then you pay like either a monthly fee for the subscription, or you can buy packages of recipes, and it narrates to you what to do. And you can say next or back, and it progresses through the recipe as you stand in the kitchen. It is amazing. And the recipes look really good. I didn't actually cook anything from it yet because I'm lazy, but I did enjoy poking at it and talking to it and telling it what to do. So thank you, Aaron, not just for the awesome app recommendation and for what will hopefully be an improvement in my kitchen in days to come, but also for informing us that the future really super is here.
So driving directions, that's one thing where like turn by turn voice navigation, cooking's another one. I'm trying to think of what else could
building
we use
IKEA furniture.
Oh, that's true. And it would just keep saying, no, really, look at the directions. No, really, read the directions. No, really, read the directions.
No, just, really, that screw's not extra.
Yeah. I guess that'd be a good one. How about like computer, like walking you through a new software program? That would be pretty cool,
right?
That would
be cool. I think workout stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Would be good.
I mean, that's what a personal trainer is, right? Push it. Three more.
Yeah.
Three more.
Not even motivational, but like, you know, now you do 15
sit-ups. You have now burned 38 calories.
Right. And, right. Because it can count your calories and your steps if you're wearing it on your wrist. So if it told you, you know, jog and you started jogging and then it told you when to stop and start walking, and you could do interval training, or you could do like drop and give me 50 push-ups, and then you do those and you say, okay, next. And then it would clock like how long it took you to do your 50 push-ups.
Oh, I like that's a good one too. There's all sorts of stuff we could use this for. It's like a butler for getting stuff done. All right.
Can David Allen make a getting stuff done thing that will just talk to me all day long? Move to the next task on your list.
Weekly review. All right. So before we get into the big stories, let's do the first sponsor. Tell me about our first sponsor.
Our first sponsor this week is Swoon Reads. They are back. Swoon Reads is a new model of publishing that's dedicated to finding undiscovered talent by harnessing the power of a community of readers. And they're not just saying it's a community. It actually is a community. They have YA romance writers and then a ton of readers who just love YA romance. And so writers put up their unpublished manuscripts and readers get to read and comment on them. And the folks who run Swoon Reads, who are also from Macmillan Publishers, pay attention to that. And they promised when they launched it back in the fall that they would be publishing the best works that they found in Swoon Reads. And now they're making good on that promise. They have their first list of trade paperback originals. And the very first one of those, which is coming out in this fall of 2014, is called A Little Something Different by Sandy Hall. And it is an irresistibly sweet and completely original, this morning with sound effects, completely original contemporary romance about two college students who don't realize that they are meant to be. And it's told from 14 different viewpoints. So I will be keeping a lookout for that because rotating narrators are a thing that I really, really, really love. But Swoon Reads is doing really interesting things. You can find them at swoonreads.com and they're all over social media. And there's more Swoon Reads books coming soon. So they are really, you know, moving into this future of publishing, of not just giving anybody a place to feel like they're getting criticism, but where you can get real criticism from real readers who love the genre, know it, and who know it well, and get a shot to have your work published. Pretty great.
Very cool.
Yeah, thank you, Swoon Reads, for sponsoring the show again. And listeners, if you want to check it out, swoonreads.com. They're on Twitter at Swoon Reads. They have a Facebook page. Let them know that we sent you and support the show.
All right. So, shall we dive into a little controversy? There's always a little.
There's always a little. There's a lot of, we have some good meaty things this week.
There is. That is true. So we talked a while back about on the show, and I don't remember what brought it up. Oh, wasn't it the kid who wrote a letter or something?
Yes, there was a little girl who wrote a letter about sexism in books for kids.
Yeah, books for boys, books for girls, that kind of labeling. And this week, a petition was started, I think, over in jolly old England, if I remember correctly. Let's see if I've got this right. In the UK is where it started. A couple of titles, like The Beautiful Girls Book of Coloring, and it has a U in it, which is how I know, or Illustrated Classics for Boys. Mm-hmm. A group wrote a letter to the publisher of a couple different publishers, actually, saying, and this, I'll read the letter directly. Please stop labeling books in the title or on the packaging as for girls or for boys. Children's publishing should always aim to open up new worlds for children, but telling children which stories and activities are for them based on their gender closes down whole worlds of interest. We're asking you to stop labeling books this way and let children decide for themselves what kinds of stories and activity books they find interesting. Sincerely, so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's part of it. Do we want to talk about that before looping in the second piece, or what do you want to do? Let's start there. Let's pause there.
And now it's available as a petition online.
Yes, change.org. Link in the show notes for you.
You can check that out also.
So you go first.
I am totally in favor of this.
Okay.
I think it's problematic that we label toys and books and movies and all sorts of media as for boys and for girls, and that those are different kinds of things. And we start labeling those, sending gendered messages about what boys should be and what girls should be before kids are even born. Like, if you've ever been to baby showers, you have seen this in action. And the way that we talk about what a little girl will be and what a little boy will be, and arguably boys get the better end of the stick in publishing and in media. Little boys get to be adventurous and they get to fight dragons and they get to do all sorts of things. And little girls are given like princess dresses and baby dolls. And so you can be pretty and you can have babies. I think those are problematic messages, and anything that we do with media that opens up the options for every child is a good thing. If little girls self-select into wearing dresses, that is fine. Parents and communities are still going to have the, you know, messages about what they believe to be essential gender traits and where you fall on the spectrum of believing in gender as a socially constructed category versus a natural one is up to you. But I think this is a valuable conversation to have, if nothing else, about what do we say about what we think about gender and what's expected of boys and girls? And that leads into what's expected of men and women. So I think even though people can dust it off as, oh, they're just kids, you know, it's not really harmful. What we tell children affects what they believe about who they are going into their adult lives. And that's certainly meaningful.
Yeah. I mean, I agree on the general principle. I guess what I'm more interested in, just because I don't think there's much to argue with in that regard. It's the four girls and four boys part. So I guess what I'm thinking is, if these two books, the Beautiful Girls Coloring Book and the Brilliant Boys Coloring Book, just took out the girls and the boys and left the content and the color schemes the same, the messaging is clearly different. But that would certainly satiate the petition, at least as it's worded.
So you mean like if the contents of the books were identical?
Yeah.
But they could still call the pink one girls and the blue one boys?
Yeah. Okay. Or vice versa. Or where you just take out the girl-boy name on the title and leave the contents the same. So
yeah.
I'm not sure. I guess if you want to sign this petition, I have absolutely no problem with it, and I would probably sign something like myself. I think there's a little bit, you know, kind of like treating symptoms rather than causes to me. You know, I don't ever want to discourage someone from carrying something they care about, but I don't know where you fight this problem. I don't know if this is the right place to put time and attention, because I'm not actually sure that the girls and boys maybe even doing a lot of the buying these books. I think the parents and family members or people giving gifts do a lot of this kind of buying as well. And it's just a much more root problem in how we imagine gender to be. And I don't know. I totally agree that girls' imaginations and boys' imaginations get closed off by this kind of thing. But I'm not sure that I don't know where to go. I mean, maybe this is where you can go, because this is like the most obvious, and like it's on the book. It said four girls, pink, beautiful, four boys, blue, brilliant. Like,
right. Yeah. I think this is an interesting place to go. And I think this is a more effective place to start the conversation than the letter that the little girl wrote that we talked about several months ago. She wrote a letter to a bookstore. She was very upset, or she complained to a bookseller who took the message to their manager that the books for girls that they displayed were really different in content from the books for boys, and that she, you know, felt closed off and limited by that and offended by it. Bookstores can only sell what publishers make available to them. So telling a bookstore that their display is problematic is one thing to do, but it starts sooner. It starts with, I don't know if publishers are where it starts. It probably starts with what you choose to write or create.
Or what you think people are going to buy. I mean, that's what really starts, right?
I mean, a lot of publishing is driven by what you think people will buy. But there's a conversation to be had, and I do think it's more valuable to have it with publishers, with the source of the content, than with the people who are farther down the chain, at least right now. If this is where we're going, if we're moving towards not labeling books and media as four girls and four boys, then you start with the people who create and sell the media, right?
Yeah, I mean, and you know, the way that you should really do this is not writing a letter to the publisher, it's boycotting the books and telling people not to buy them. Because in a related story, Michael O'Mara, who is the publisher of Buster Books, which is actually sells the, oh, actually, no, he doesn't actually sell the two we mentioned, but like other books like this.
Yeah, there are a ton of things like this where it's like the, you know, adventurous book for boys and the beautiful book for girls.
Yeah, he said, we're not going to stop doing stuff like this because they sell. Let's see. Let me read his direct language, because I don't want to misquote him before I stomp on. Or no, I'm not going to stomp on the guy, but it's a fact of life how a very large percentage of people shop when buying for kids, do it by sex. I'm not sure that sentence makes a lot of sense. But anyway, we know for a fact that they are, when they're shopping on Amazon, they quite often type in books for boys and books for girls. All boys don't like one thing and all girls the other. But the fact is a lot of boys like the same things and a lot of girls like the same things. We can't ignore the fact that they are definitely different. Okay.
This man is really pretty confident about fact.
Yeah. Facts of life, cultural constructions are not facts. I mean, they are facts, but they're not not indefatigable.
Red flags.
And
raise
I don't
up
know how he
knows
fact of life. What search terms Amazon people are typing into because Amazon tells nobody that information.
Yeah. No one knows what people are typing into Amazon. Nobody.
But let's just say that he's right. Just that he's right about people search
then
for him this way.
Wouldn't it be amazing if you got the same results
there you go.
When you typed in books for girls and books for boys mm-hmm. because books labeled differently didn't exist. And so you got to choose from the whole pool and decide for yourself. I think there's, I do think it's probably true that people are looking for gifts for boys and gifts for girls. I know when I was a bookseller that we would get, you know, aunts and uncles and friends of families and people coming in and saying, like, I'm looking for a book for a five-year-old boy. And that the feeling as a bookseller then is like, okay, well, what else about this five-year-old boy? Like, the fact that he's five and a boy doesn't really tell you anything about mm-hmm. what kind of book he's going to be
interested
into.
In. Yeah.
Yeah.
On the other hand, I'm just saying, let's say that he's not an idiot and that he actually, there's some truth to the metascale thing that there's a big centralized group around kinds of books for boys and books for girls. I don't know if you're going to, I mean, publishers are in this to make money. And so the way to hit them is not shame, it's money. Mm-hmm. Right. So I'm not really arguing that you to let these publishers do whatever they want. But don't sign a petition. Tell people not to buy it, not to buy these books, mm-hmm. and they'll stop making them.
Yeah, I think that's more effective. Speak with your dollars. I do think, though, that this argument of we're going to keep making these because these are what people buy is that's a circular argument. This is what we make available to people, so it's what they have to choose from, mm-hmm. and therefore they buy from what's available. If you stopped printing books that say four girls and four boys on them, and someone walked into a bookstore and asked for a book for girls, if the bookseller said, like, I'm sorry, there's nothing labeled for girls, they don't make that kind of book anymore, but here is another thing, I would guess that person then is just going to buy the other thing. They're not going to never buy a book for a girl just because it's not labeled for girls. If you change what's available in the market, then consumers have to make different choices.
Yeah, and on the other hand, he says, I'm just looking at the stats, he says, okay, great. So, I mean, again, I'm paraphrasing and making him sound more like a jerk than he might be.
Well, it's a fact of life.
2,000 people signed this petition the first day, but we sold 500,000 copies of the girl's book. That math is extremely hard to argue with.
Mm-hmm.
The statistics tell me I'm going in the right direction. Well, we can argue about what statistics can or can't tell you. We would never publish a book that demeaned one sex or the other. I think by calling one beautiful girls and brilliant boys, you have already done that.
Yes, you have.
Jack Hole. So I don't know. I mean, I guess what I'm trying to do is recognize the complexity of the problem, and yet you have to attack it somewhere. And so maybe even if it's not the best way to attack it, attacking it is just good to do, even if it's an imp. This is a trap we sometimes fall into as well. That's not going to do exactly what you want it to do, but there's no perfect way mm-hmm. of getting started the ball
this
rolling
has gotten
on this
people talking about it, and so bringing attention to mm-hmm. the problem is valuable in and of itself. And then if you as a parent or an aunt or uncle or a friend of someone who's having kids agree with this, or if this is the first time you've ever thought about what might be going on with books labeled for girls and books labeled for boys, then it's great that this conversation came up, that we're talking about it in the book community now, and it gives you an opportunity to make different choices about the kinds of things that you buy, and if nothing else, to think about the kind of messages that you're sending to kids.
I want to just go back to the beginning because I'm now struggling with what I think is a more interesting question than this one about this guy and the book. But so the two books, if you have the beautiful coloring book and it's pink and it's got butterflies and
like
cakes
glitter,
if you just called it beautiful coloring book and left it as it is, just took girls out,
mm-hmm.
and then you took the brilliant coloring book, took boys out, and it's got a Viking helmet and a kite and a shooting star and some sort of ray gun, and you left those, that would obey the letter of the petition. But I still think it would, the spirit would not be. I'm just not sure that getting rid of the because it's even, it's, I guess it's even more like subtly gendered.
Yeah, the one with the pink cover is still going to get shelved with girl stuff, and the one with the blue cover is going to be shelved with the boy stuff. Like, if you've ever walked down the Target toy section at the holidays, you've seen, it's a really striking thing that there are like three aisles of pink things, and the aisles are literally labeled like girls.
Are they labeled girls? Because our local Target, Saturday mornings, my son and I often will make a Target run to get all the things that we need, you know, our $100 Target run that everyone does. And we'll go up and wander around the toy section. And I've noticed this too, but it's not labeled boys or girls.
I'm
going
to have to double check. It feels like I have seen that, but I could just be imposing it because it's so obviously.
Well, it might as well be. But it isn't.
And the boy aisles have all kinds of colors in them, and they have cars, and they have dragons, and they have dinosaurs, and they have Legos and things that you can build. And the girl stuff is sort of like ghettoized on its three aisles of baby dolls and, you know, fake cribs and stuff. And so I think what I would want here is like one coloring book that's like a yellow cover that's awesome coloring book, and like some of the pages in it are butterflies with glitter and some of the pages are Viking helmets, and as you're a kid you can scroll through them and decide which ones you want to color in, and maybe it's never occurred to you before that you're a girl and you can color a Viking helmet, but there's a Viking helmet that's available to you.
Yeah, and I'm not an economist, but there's something to me that feels like you don't attack the supply side of the issue. You got to figure out how to attack the demand side, and it might just take time and talking about it overtly, and getting people to be cognizant of what they're buying and what they're not buying.
Like, this guy's explicitly saying we're not going to stop because these keep selling.
Yeah,
so the way to stop him is to stop buying them.
Stop buying them. So I guess maybe the message is, if you're buying books for kids, and if you have kids and people are buying books for you, you might just say, you know, we don't want books that are overtly for girls and overtly for boys. We want stuff that is just interesting for kids. And maybe we can suck up some of the demand, and then the supply goes away, and in that vacuum will be more interesting stuff for kids of all kinds.
Yes.
All right. We've got four studies here.
So many. It was a good week.
Good week. Let's start with this one I linked to the other day. Reading literary fiction can make you less racist is the headline in the Pacific Standard. And this was a study done at Washington and Lee that had a bunch of people read a snippet of a novel about a Muslim woman, and then they did some tests after the fact to gauge people's reactions and how their thinking might have been changed. So they read this piece. It's a 3,000-word extract from Shaila Abdullah's 2009 novel, Saffron Dreams. It's about a strong-willed Muslim woman and moves to New York and is assaulted there and whatever. It's literary fiction, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. And then the participants in the first experiment, these were 68 Americans recruited online, read the excerpt or a 500-word synopsis of the same scene. Okay, that's the difference. In the synopsis, descriptive language, monologue, and dialogue were removed to reduce narrative quality. Then, after they were done, both groups, they viewed a series of ambiguous race faces and rated them on a 4-point scale. Are they Arab, mixed, more Arab than Caucasian, 3, more Caucasian than Arab, or 4, Caucasian? Those who read the rich, detailed narrative made significantly fewer categorical racial judgments compared to those who simply read the synopsis. The second experiment featured 110 people similarly recruited, and then they were given this, so the same thing, a synopsis versus the narrative, and then afterward they were given 12 images of the ambiguous Arab-Caucasian faces with varying levels of anger expression. So they got 12 images, sort of like from neutral or happy to pissed off, I guess, and were instructed to classify them on the 4-point scale. Those who read the actual excerpt were less likely to characterize the angry faces as Arab. right? Mm-hmm. So what you happen in one, so what they're doing essentially is correlating racial bias to calling angry people of ambiguous race the race you're prejudiced against. I didn't explain that very well, I don't think.
Yes, but psychology research does this a lot, where they try to take, they use some piece of material to try to induce participants into a certain emotional or mental state, and then examine if that was done successfully, and if so, like what this state does to the way that you make judgments or the way that you make decisions about other things. And so what they were, the real question here is, does reading something that puts you in the shoes of a Muslim woman who is possibly not the experience that you're living on a daily basis if you're a participant in this research, does reading something that puts you in the mental state of thinking about someone else's lived experience who's a member of a minority racial group make you less likely to make stereotypical judgments after you've been put into that state by reading the synopsis? And so the, like, that's the, I'm not doing a very good job here.
It's a little hard to explain.
That's the experimental manipulation. Right. The control group read the 500-word synopsis that doesn't put you in anyone's experience. And then the experimental group read the 3,000-word excerpt that is literary fiction that presumably does the thing that fiction is supposed to do, where it gets you to imagine yourself into someone else's life.
So I got some problems with the experiment. Just, I know you're shocked. So it's 3,000-word narrative against a 500-word synopsis. Do you see where I'm going here?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, one of them is six times longer than the other.
Yes.
So it could, I mean, couldn't it be not stylistic or empathy magic that
you're talking
fiction
about
does?
A confounding factor.
Yeah, I mean, you just spent more time reading about that person.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, it's not just a qualitative but quantitative difference they did. Because I think it's interesting that they didn't, it wasn't just sort of like, did you read something about a Muslim woman versus you just came in out of the clear blue ocean, we gave you nothing. It was
right.
Actually the information they were trying to codify in one way.
I think a really interesting way to do it would have been like a control group who reads 3,000 words about something that has nothing to do with this.
Yeah.
A group that reads 3,000 words where a white woman moves to New York and is attacked on the
right.
subway.
Yes.
And then an experimental group that reads the 3,000 words about a Muslim woman with the mm-hmm. same experience. And then you have a more robust comparison. My problem started when the sample was 68 people.
Yeah, recruited. Online
who
too.
Recruited online, and then there's a second experiment that had 110 people. That's a pretty small sample size to draw from.
And a biased one because of online and who's
right,
available
and
like
accessibility,
who's gonna do it.
Right. We've talked about studies like this before. Readers like these,
of course, because
we can feel.
I'm not racist, and books are cool.
And we can feel in our experience that reading does make us in some way walk in someone else's shoes or think about a different kind of lived experience than we have. And that's one of the things that readers talk about as loving about reading. And so this is a nice confirmation that, hey, reading really does what we think it does.
Or what we want it to do.
Right, what we wish it could do. The last time we talked about a study like this, I think you and I were both skeptical about how long
yes.
do these effects last. You know, if you read 3,000 words and then you immediately, on the heels of reading those 3,000 words, are faced with these pictures, maybe your ratings change then. But are there, I think the study goes towards maybe what can we do to create longer term effects?
Yeah, like do you have to read 3,000 words about a Muslim woman getting raped every day
every
not to
morning.
Be a racist jerk? Like that
right,
seems,
like this is,
I don't know.
It's called the mere exposure effect is what they're getting at here. And if you've seen, like, Remember the Titans, that's mm-hmm. what that plays on. That it's a social psychological phenomenon that just being exposed, like actually exposed in person to having some sort of interaction or relationship with a person from a different group than you are a member of makes you less biased against that group of people. Because you move from the theoretical of this is what I think Muslim people are like to the concrete of now I have experienced an actual Muslim person or mm-hmm. an actual, in Remember the Titans, an actual black person. And so like that story becomes an illustration of what's really a fact, like known to be a fact in social psychology, that getting people to work close and in person with people of different social groups makes everybody less biased mm-hmm. in the long run. So if reading about a Muslim woman can do this in the short term, then maybe they're starting to think about how can we apply this principle to our at Washington and Lee, maybe like to our classrooms and our communities, and what can we do to American society to like encourage more mixing between groups, and knowing that that will result in fewer stereotypes.
You know what this just got me thinking about? The story we talked about last week where the jerk in South Carolina wants to withhold funding for reading stuff about lesbians. I mean, this is going to sound weird, but for what he wants to do, he's kind of right to be scared of it, if this is true, right?
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah, yeah.
Because like if the thing he really doesn't, if he doesn't want is to be increased empathy for non-heterosexual sexualities, then getting students that are freshmen to read about a complicated, nuanced lesbian is doing exactly the thing he doesn't want them to.
Exactly. The way to maintain all of your stereotypes and biases is to never expose yourself to real humans in those groups that you are stereotyped and biased against.
I mean, he's doing the wrong thing the right way, weirdly. Yeah, anything else about this study? Like, again, I want this to be true just as much as everyone else because I like not being racist and I like books. But I'm not comfortable being too pom-pommy about this, if you know what I'm saying.
Yeah, I think whenever studies like this come out, and what we talk about here on the show all the time is the thing I really wish that publishing would do a better job of, and the book community, is asking the real questions here rather than just passing around the link and saying, oh, good, I knew it was true. Literary fiction makes you less racist. Like, it's such a good headline, but there are so many interesting questions to be asked and important conversations to be had about it. And I want us to go to that place. And if this is true, then like this has implications for, you know, high school reading lists. Like, we should be looking at making sure that all sorts of social groups and that members of all races are represented in the fiction that students read throughout their education, in hopes that by the time we turn them loose on the world when they're 18, if books really do help you jump that empathy gap between your experience and someone else's, then we need to be assigning books that and exposing kids to as many different kinds of books as possible so that they can bridge those gaps and better interact with an increasingly diverse society, which I think is a good thing.
Yeah. Two more problems, just quick mentions. Mm-hmm. So there were 12 images of ambiguous Arab Caucasian faces. Like, how do you like show them to a group of people, and if half of them think they're Arabs and half of them think they're Caucasian, you say that's ambiguous?
I think that they actually have like, that researchers have like banks of
that, but that's what I mean. Like
photos.
That's how they've been determined.
That's how they get. That's how they get to those places.
And they also didn't say anything about the gender of the faces that were being shown. Like, so this is the story is about a woman who gets raped on a New York City subway platform. I mean, you could imagine, do the male ambiguous faces get the effect of the increased empathy, supposedly, or is it just the female faces, or would it be...
Oh, and now I'm wondering if the race of the rapist is mentioned in the synopsis, too, because if it's like a white man who's raping this Muslim woman, then maybe you are now imagining angry... white men and are more likely to rate those faces as angry. So lots of it.
And
lots
we don't
of
know
stuff
anything about the. We don't know anything about the demographic of the mere 68 people.
Right.
Like, did they do an even gender split? Are they? How, do we anything about their ages? I mean, likely to be younger if they're online.
I mean, most psychology research is done with Psych 101 students who get course credit for participating in studies on their campuses, and so often when you read journals or pieces like this, it'll be like 68 students at a Midwestern private liberal arts university, and like you can sort of draw the lines there.
So, I mean, in either case, the recruits came from the same pool, but if 68 is small enough where if you have like a 60-40 gender split, or you happen to get a disproportionate number of racial minorities in your group, you know, it can skew the whole thing. Anyway, so it's interesting. I think we both think there's maybe some kernel of truth to it, but it's very, very, very disclaimer heavy for me from this particular story. All right. So these aren't psychological studies, these next couple. These are actual stats that, I mean, I guess we could poke at methodologies if we want to. But the big one this week was the Pew Research Center's Internet and American Life Project's findings on American engagement with libraries. Mm-hmm. And the top line story for me is that 79% of Americans, 16 and older, report having at least a medium engagement with their public libraries. Mm-hmm. And that seems like a big number to me. 79%? Mm-hmm. Like it's hard to imagine. What other thing does 79% of Americans report having a higher engagement with, like stoplights? Like it's hard even to think what it would be. I'm only 10% kidding about that.
It was a surprisingly high number to me, mm-hmm. too, and encouragingly high. And they break out the different kinds of library users in really fascinating ways. Yeah.
So what's your next pick for
my next pick? What is my next pick? Okay, so of high engagement, the high engagement users, they consider to be, it's the like top 30%. And those are library lovers, which make up 10% of the U.S. population, mm-hmm. ages 16 and up, according to this study. And those are people who report frequent personal use of public libraries, and they have high levels of household library use. They include parents, students, and job seekers, and members tend to be younger with high levels of education. Mm-hmm. And then that high engagement group is also what they call information omnivores, which they say is 20% of the U.S. population over the age of 16, which seems, I guess, high to me, but I'm stoked if there are that many people who really are like just really into getting information about things.
Right.
They have the highest rates of technology use, as well as the highest levels of education, employment, and household income, high levels of personal and household library use, and slightly less frequent visits to the library than library lovers. So what came out to me there is we talk about often the importance and value of libraries for providing services to people who don't have access to them otherwise, or who haven't learned about information technology, or who are seeking just how to set up an email address or job application assistance and all of the various new kinds of literacy that modern day librarians are required for. But I guess I was surprised that these that the folks that are the most into using their libraries come from higher levels of education and income.
Yeah.
I guess there's a correlation there between level of education and literacy, and so the ability to read and to find reading to be interesting and fun, and therefore to want to go to your library and love your library. But that was that busted a couple of my stereotypes for sure.
I thought also I was interested in the non-engagement groups, like who are the people. The 10%, they call them distant admirers.
Yeah.
They never use a library, but people in their house might use a library, or that they have favorable views of a library.
And that's people who have never used a library.
Yeah, right. Which I thought was interesting. So who they are, 27% Hispanic, which I think is telling, right? Mm-hmm. When's the last time you went to your library and saw a huge Spanish language section? The answer to that is going to be probably never.
Right. Why go if there's nothing for you there?
Somewhat higher proportion of men, 56%, than the general population. Mm-hmm. They are more likely to have relatively lower levels of education. 62% did not attend college, and household income. Those two things are highly correlated. Mm-hmm. They are less likely than some of the other groups to know many neighbors. And they participate at rates that are considerably below the national benchmark for participation in other community activities.
Okay, so if you don't do other things in your community, you're not going to the library. That makes sense.
Mm-hmm. 40% of the distant admirers say that someone in their household is a library user. And two-thirds of them, 68%, say libraries are important to them because they promote literacy and reading. So it's like they know libraries are important, or believe they're important, but don't use them. Which I think is interesting.
Yeah, I mean, it's like I'm glad that ESPN exists for people who care about sports, but I don't really watch it.
Mm-hmm. And then 4% is off the grid, and they're just like, these are the complete whack. I mean, mm-hmm. there's just very hard transients, and men haven't finished high school and don't connect. I guess you're not surprised, but that's only the bottom 4%. But that group that like doesn't use a library but feels good about libraries, I think, is a really interesting. Let's see.
And then there's a small group that they mentioned, but there's not much information on in the study, of people who have really negative feelings about libraries. Like, mm-hmm. I want to meet these people. Who are you that feel really negative about
libertarians? They don't like the tax dollars. I'll buy my own books. Thank you very much.
But wouldn't they want more information to be available to people so they can make their own decisions about things rather than...
Yeah, but you buy that information. It's a free market, Rebecca. Fully 91% of Americans ages 16 and older say they know where the closest library is. I think that's very good. Mm-hmm. And 72% live within 5 miles of a library, which 5 miles, I guess that's pretty close.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm in a weird position because 5 miles in New York is like 10,000 miles in other places. Right.
But also there are huge swaths of central, you know, middle America that are rural and where 5 miles is close.
93% of Americans say it would be easy for them to visit their local library in person. So that, I mean, it's hard to get a better number than that.
Yeah,
honestly. Including 74% of those in the off the grid group. Hmm. 82% of Americans say library websites would be easy for them to use. Let's see. I think that pretty much covers it. If you've got, you can see the full, we'll do a link to the full study here. Mm-hmm. That's pretty good. The high engagement stuff, info omnivores,
one I thought was really interesting is that most Americans do not feel overwhelmed by information.
That's a good one.
It's down near the bottom.
The bottom of what?
The bottom of this link.
Oh, okay. I'm deep into the main of the study here. So,
18% of Americans say that they feel overloaded by information, a drop in those from 27% who reported information overload was a problem for them in 2006. And those who feel overloaded are actually less likely to use the internet or smartphones and are more represented in groups with the lower levels of library engagement, which that makes sense. Like if you're overwhelmed by what's available to you, you are probably more likely to put your phone down or to step away from the internet. But that drop from 27% saying they felt overloaded by information in 2006 to 18% feeling it is, I think, really telling about what we're doing with web literacy, because the internet is so much bigger than it was in 2006. There's so much more information and writing being done exclusively for the web, and reporting, and Twitter is a thing now. And this seems to say that Americans are getting better at managing all of that incoming information, or we've just attenuated to it, that it's all right there at our fingertips. We are flooded all of the time, but it doesn't feel scary in the way that it felt scary or overwhelming.
Well, I've thought about that before as kind of like how I felt about New York when I first moved here. Like it was overwhelming. But you get used to it and you kind of know where to go and what to avoid and also feel more comfortable exploring. Right. And so New York itself has changed since I moved here, but the overwhelmingness factor hasn't changed. Let's just talk about the top level group, the library lovers, the power users. They're the most heavily female dominated group. 62% of them are women. Mm-hmm. Their median age is 44.
Okay.
They're a somewhat upscale group in terms of household income. 39% live in households earning more than $50,000 a year. Still, relatively high proportions of them don't work. I think we're talking about single moms here.
Yeah, and one that says 23% have recently lost jobs or seen a significant loss of income. 25% are currently looking for a job. Single moms, women who aren't working but who want to be working, 25% currently looking for a job. 17% of these library lovers are students.
That sounds like Judy Book Buyer. We talked about the profile of the most rapacious book buyers.
Right, it says this group includes heavy book readers, 66% of them read daily.
They didn't break out ethnic and racial in this group, which I think is very odd.
Yeah.
Oh, wait, no, I'm sorry. It's down in Buffalo.
Okay.
66% white. That's not a surprise.
Also active socially and engaged with community events, and they rate their communities highly, and they're heavy internet users as well, particularly engaged with mobile. It's a 72% of them go online with mobile devices. There's so much good stuff here, and I love the Pew research studies because their methodology is generally so
very
solid
good,
that we get to ask interesting questions instead of cranky questions.
No, that's right. We can look at effects and causes. Community types, I think, is interesting. The South actually has the highest percentage of library lovers. 32% of library lovers are in the South. And oh, wait, I'm sorry. I'm looking at this wrong because I should be looking at relative population. Mm. So the Midwest actually has more library lovers per capita. Oh, let me get this right. Okay, hold on. Let me try this again. So in the Midwest, 23% of library lovers live in the Midwest, and the Midwest has 22% of the population. So it's about equal. The South has the lowest proportion of library lovers per capita, with 32% of library lovers, but they comprise 37% of the American population.
Okay.
So the group that actually does the best, it's only moderate, is the West. Mm-hmm. They have 26% of library lovers and just 23% of the population.
Yeah. And there's also a note about the print traditionalists, which they say make up 9% of the population. And that has the of print traditionalists, which I guess is people who are sticking to print and aren't interested in ebooks, is the highest proportion of rural. 61% of the print traditionalists live in rural populations. Of white people, 75% of print traditionalists are white, and 50% of them are Southern. So you've got the South, rural Southern white people is like the Venn diagram of most likely to strongly prefer print. And so then active library use or being a library lover makes extra sense there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that really does make sense. Library lovers also disproportionately also use the internet. They also disproportionately have broadband at home. And they, let's see, have a disproportionate number have a tablet computer. I guess that probably tracks to personal income as well. Wow. All right. I'm going to don't look at it. See if you can guess. So what percentage of library lovers report going to a bookstore regularly? What percentage do you think it would be?
Well, did they say what regularly is?
Yes. Oh, no. They report, they say, do you go regularly to a bookstore? And they say yes or no.
Oh, 65.
It's 57. So you're pretty close.
Okay.
50, pretty close.
Well, so that's also an interesting point towards the argument. Like, there's this sort of back and forth in publishing constantly of like, do people not buy books because they go to their library? And publishing tends to say, no, libraries do, like, library use is correlated to book purchasing as well. Like, very few people do exclusively one or the other.
Yeah. Though 43% of library lovers then don't go to a bookstore regularly. I mean, I don't know if there's anything to make of that.
I mean, I think it's problematic to ask regularly rather than to define regularly. Like, because what I think is regular might be not what you think is regular.
Yeah, but that probably moderates over a large group of sample, right?
Maybe.
There's a side bit of information that it says 32% of Americans go to a bookstore regularly.
I still want to know what regularly means.
Yeah. All right. Well, I think we got into that one, didn't we? We like that. That's right. It's hard to find something we like more.
This is
than
going
that.
Quickly this morning. I'm looking at the clock.
I know. We got to go. Let's see. We've got two. Well, maybe we can do these two UK studies real quick. A couple of stories in the Telegraph this week about surveys about Brits. Mm-hmm. And a new study finds that more than half the books lining shelves in British homes have never been read. The survey was conducted by the self-storage firm Shurgard. So we could have a biased funding source, which makes a difference. Because I guess they might be interested in you moving your books to their unread books to their self-storage. Anyway, found the average home has 138 books in the UK, and that half those books are unread.
Oh, what?
Weird, right?
I am calling so many shenanigans.
Where are your shenanigans?
So what we know is that of 2,000 adults that are somehow connected to Shurgard self-storage, like, what if it's all customers of self-storage? That's really interesting. Like, people who have to have storage spaces have more stuff.
Self-storage space, wouldn't you be more likely to keep your unread books in storage?
The average home having 138 books seems high.
Yeah, so I guess it could be if you can afford a self-storage unit and that's how they got you. Yeah, I don't know.
And then 2/3 of those who took part in the study said they kept their books because they were emotionally attached to them, while over 1 in 4 said they hated throwing anything away.
It's a little confusing.
Yeah, I have some problems here. Mm-hmm. I have lots of problems here. I don't think this really tells us anything. Except that of 2,000 people that Shurgard found and asked questions to, a lot of them had books that they had never bought, which, like, if you're in a home that has an average of 138 books, which seems like a really high national average, and I would guess is significantly higher than the number of books on the average American's bookshelf, you're probably like us in some ways. You're like a hardcore reader who maybe buys books and it takes a while to get around to getting to all those things.
Yeah, like, I guess so.
Of the
two-thirds of those who took part said they kept books because they were emotionally attached to them, and while over 1 in 4 said they hated throwing anything away.
Like, if you really truly hate throwing anything away, anything at all, like your gum wrapper, you're talking about a hoarding situation.
Well, they'd have more than 138 books.
That's true.
All right. I mean, it's not rigorous, but I thought that one was interesting. Two, let's do another UK one.
That's the Department of Headlines Without Much Substance.
Yeah. This one I thought was really interesting. This was Reading Habits of Brits Again. And again, I mean, if this is also... It's like it's got scare headlines, right? Deep class divide in reading habits. It's actually not as deep as it sounds, but I guess they in the UK there looks like there's these familiar acronyms of DEs and ABs, and basically DEs are lower income people and ABs are higher income people. I don't know what it correlates to, but this is how this article uses it. 62% of the higher income group read daily or weekly compared with 42% of the lower income group, which is a difference, but would you call that a divide? Like, that's not what the title, I mean.
Yeah. I mean, no, and there are lots of factors there.
Yeah.
But if you have higher income, you're probably not working three jobs and therefore
Or you're not doing manual labor all day, so you're not world weary.
Right, you have leisure time to read.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's part of it. The part I was most interested in is, let's see, where does it say? Here we go. The ABs not only read more, but they also felt better about their reading, which I think is, I've never thought about that correlation. Where did I put that? Anyway, it's around the same statistic.
Oh yeah, I see here. 85% of the ABs say that reading helps to make them feel good, where 69% of DEs say that reading helps to make them feel good. So that's a 16%.
Yeah, so in the
difference,
the split between the reading one weekly at all is 20%. So the gap there is a little narrower in the feeling one, but I never really thought about, like, even if you do read in a lower economic bracket, you still feel differently about the reading. You manage to find time and space to do. And I don't know what to make of that or what the consequence of that might be, but it's a statistic I had never seen tracked at all before. So I thought I'd throw that.
Yeah, that's an interesting question to ask.
I don't know why that would be necessarily, but maybe we can ponder that and come back to it. All right. We got to do another sponsor.
Yeah, we got to
get out of here. Warby Parker. So when you're feeling good about your reading, you're probably wearing glasses. Warby Parker, it's great. I mean, it's one of those ideas that seems so obvious now that you're like, why didn't I think of that? But
right.
No, I'm an idiot, so I don't think of things like this. Warby Parker started with the idea that glasses should not cost as much as an iPhone. If you've ever been to your local optical shop or eyeglass store, you know how much glasses with lenses cost, multiple hundreds of dollars. Warby Parker said, you know what? It's just plastic and ground glass. It shouldn't be that expensive. So Warby Parker's glasses start at $95, and that includes prescription lenses. It includes the anti-glare coating. It includes polarization. They make their own glasses, and so they can keep costs down, and they make their own lenses. So that's what they really decided that they can do. And they really modern, vintage-inspired style, so you're going to look great. There's also another level, the Titanium Collection. That's their premium collection, but it only starts at $145. Mm-hmm. You buy them online. One of the more beautiful e-commerce websites you're going to see, go to warbyparker.com/bookriot. You can see all the models and makes available there in multiple colors. And then what you do is it's super easy. You can get a free home try and you pick out 5 frames. They send them to you in a box. Michelle and I just did this actually last week. So they come in this nice little box where they each get their little slot, and they have prescription-free glass in them. So you don't, you know, of course it doesn't have prescription. And you try them on the mirror. You can show them off for people. You can take pictures of them, send them to people on your phone. And then if you don't want any of them, send them back. You haven't spent any money. Pretty great.
It's pretty brilliant.
And if you want, you just tell, you can go ahead while the box is still with you, go back to your online account and say, you know what, I really want Jeremy here. And they'll get it started. And probably by the time you've sent the box back, your new prescription lenses will be there. It's all prepaid. You don't have to go to the post office and wait in line to do anything like that. And every pair of glasses sold, they also distribute a pair of glasses to someone in need. There's a lot of people out there in the world that don't have glasses. You know what percentage of people in your life are wearing glasses? Now think of places where they don't have as much access to resource and technology, and you can imagine the numbers of people that don't have glasses out there. So that's warbyparker.com/bookriot. It's a service I really like. It's a company I really like.
Yeah, and they're great.
I think if you're in the market for glasses in the near or medium term, you owe it to yourself to check them out.
Thank you to them for sponsoring the show.
Well, I think we have to go write to new books here.
I want to talk about one cool thing.
Okay, let's talk about one cool thing.
Actually, two cool things, but I'll do them really quickly.
Okay, go for it.
The first is a new reading app that launched this week that's called Rooster. You go to readrooster.com. You can get a 2-week free trial. And then if you like it, it's $4.99 a month from there
but
on.
But tell the people what it is, Rebecca. You didn't tell the people what it is.
Okay, all right. I'm getting there. Don't rush a lady talking about a rooster.
Okay, all right.
Rather than overwhelming you with reading choices, the folks at Rooster thought, what can we do just to help people get more reading in their day? So every month they pick a new book and a classic book, and they send them to you in bite-size installments. So like, and
metaphorically,
I've been doing, metaphorically bite-sized, but chunks of, you know, maybe 25 pages at a time. I've been doing it this week, and you can pick the time of day that your installments come in. So at 6 o'clock every evening, when I should be stepping away from my computer and finishing work, my phone buzzes. I get my little iPhone push notification, and I can click on Rooster, and it has given me the next chapter in the story of there's, you know, the new book and the classic book, and you can pick which one to start with, and they explain why they've made those choices. It's brand new. You put your email address in at readrooster.com to request an invite, but they've been responding really quickly to those. I think it's a cool idea, especially if you're just looking for more ways to get some reading into your daily life. You could set the installments to drop at noon every day, and then you could read over your lunch break. You know, the choice is limited rather than unlimited, so you don't have to suffer from like which book to start with. I think it's pretty cool. It's just nice to see these options rolling out, and the app works really well. It's beautiful.
It's cheap,
it's slick. $4.99 a month for two books. Not bad at all. Definitely worth something. I think definitely worth trying out if it's a thing that sounds good to you. Also, our hero of the week is Lottie Fields.
Oh, yes.
Who is a New Yorker who died last summer at the age of 89. She inherited wealth from her husband's family, and she loved to read. And so she left $6 million to the New York Public Library.
Man.
Just the fact that this exists in the world makes me feel good about life.
Her executor said, one of her great joys was spending the weekend reading with her husband. I mean, come on.
Yep.
Jeez.
Good for them. Thank you, Lottie Fields.
All right, new books.
A little bit of a quieter week for new books this week, but we've got Shotgun Love Songs by Nicholas Butler, which is a debut novel set in a small town in Wisconsin about a group of four friends who were, you know, raised up together and then went out, separated as they grew up. Far flung, but now they are all four brought back together for a wedding in their small town of Little Wing, Wisconsin. And while their lifelong bonds are still strong, there are also stresses between the friends, between husbands and wives. There's heartbreak, there's hope and healing. I have this sitting on my pile to start very soon because I love The Gang Gets Back Together. Mm-hmm. Meg Wolitzer's The Interestings did this really well last year, and I've been looking for more novels to scratch that itch.
You need to do a John or Kryptonite about this because I like this is one of my categories too. So we can come up with it.
We can write those together.
Yeah, right.
There's also The Books and Islands in Ojibwe County by Louise Erdrich, whom we both love. And her book, The Round House, won a lot of awards and accolades 2 years ago, last year. I don't remember. But recently. She's a terrific writer, and she writes about the Native American experience in the Dakotas, right? The Dakotas?
Yeah, that's right.
And so this is a memoir about the books that she grew up with, the books of her local community and the islands in that area. So maybe it's not the Dakotas. I'm sorry, Louise Erdrich, I did not study
I'm looking
geography.
It up. Keep going. I'll come back to you.
But this is great. If you, she's
Minnesota, Little Falls, Minnesota.
Okay. So she's known for, you know, writing about the Roundhouse was set on a Native American reservation, and she writes about that cultural experience and growing up in that part of the country. And so this is a memoir about that experience, but also about the books of that part of the. Of that part of America.
I'm going to have to read this, Shinsky.
I know.
I think I'm going to have to read this. This is super interesting.
I came across it in Edelweiss.
How did we not hear about this?
I was like, why is no one talking about the fact that Louise Erdrich wrote a memoir about books and islands? Like,
jeez
Louise. So we will talk about it. We are talking about it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think I'm going to read it too. I came really late to the Louise Erdrich party. But now that I'm here, I want to read all of the things.
Oh, you know, I think it's a reissue. I think that's why. Yeah. It looks like the hardcover came out like 10 years ago.
Oh, okay. Well, still, why has no one told me about
yeah,
this?
Yeah, anyway, we're still mad, but just at about a different thing.
Right. This is a thing that exists, and we hope that you will find that news to be exciting.
I'm going to read that this summer.
In paperback this week is The Bonobo and the Atheist by Franz de Waal. I just started reading this. He is one of the world's foremost primatologists, and the book is really centered around the question of where morality comes from. And if you are a person who does not believe that morality was given to us by, like, instilled in us by a higher power, you might particularly wonder, how can I be a good and moral person, even though I don't believe in God?
Mm-hmm.
And his claim is that this comes from nature. It comes from evolution. And he believes that based on years of science and research studying primates and then looking at similarities and differences between primate cultures and human culture. It's so far, it's really interesting. Definitely a controversial question, but not presented in my reading of it so far, at least, it's not presented in like a flame war kind of way at all. He's not doing the Christopher Hitchens model.
Not only do you, not only are you not uniquely good, you are actually bad. That's the Christopher Hitchens.
Right.
That's the Christopher Hitchens model.
Right. And those are the new books this week.
All right.
We were talkative today, Jeff.
I'm surprised. Where did we get hung up? I guess it was the boys and girls stuff.
It was the boys and girls. We have feelings. Yeah,
and the library stuff. We were just fascinated by that. I got a quick question for you before we go. Let's say you could commission someone to do a study.
Uh-huh.
What do you want? What do you need to know?
Well, the thing that
That you could know, right? That's not like magical, like I'm going to pull Amazon's face and they're going to tell me all their knowledge, right? Like,
I want something that could pull like every book that a reader, say, looks at online in a 3 or 6 month period and how many times they're exposed to particular titles up against what their reading habits are.
No, that's a magic one because we don't
that's
know
that. That's a
magic one? No, like one that people actually would give you, like you fill out a survey and you could do something.
That's such a good question. I don't know. Can I think about it?
Yeah, you'll just come back next week. And this is a good time to get into our how to get in touch with us. So tell us what study you'd like to know. So it has to be something where, you know, you would design the survey question and some survey company would go do it for you. And it should be about books and reading or buying or anything like that. Mm-hmm. And we'll get a few and we'll talk about them next week.
Don't
come up with it. This is a good one.
No,
we'll do
but
it.
I just came up with
no,
it.
No, keep it for next week. We're running out of time anyway. We'll both come up with one for ourselves, and we'll make it like the top segment next week. Does that sound fun?
Yes.
Well, for you and I, and it's our show. We could do it. All of you guys just have to suffer through it. I'm so
sorry. And now I'm just going to have ants in my pants
Yeah,
for a
well,
week.
Write it out and don't show it to me. So submit your idea for a survey, and we'll talk about them next week. And if you have an interesting one, we'll mention you as well. podcast@bookriot.com is the email. You can rate us, not us, we're not actually on iTunes, but the show's on iTunes. Just search for Book Riot there. Always can find us at bookriot.com on Facebook or Twitter. Podcast.com/bookriot. Excuse me.
No.
Come on, you do it. Your turn.
Bookriot.com.
Get me out of this. I'm going to dug myself
podcast.
A hole.
Bookriot.com/podcast is where you can find the show notes. You can find Jeff on Twitter at Reading Ape, and you can find me at Rebecca Shinsky. When this show drops this weekend, also a new episode, episode number 5 of our other podcast that our dear friend and colleague Rita Mead hosts for Book Riot called Dear Book Nerd will be going out as well. She is a great guest this week, and that is a show that answers your questions about life, love, and literature. It's a write-in advice show. It's been great so far. Let's see what else. Thank you to Warby Parker and to Swoon Reads for sponsoring this episode. And our new quarterly boxes dropped
last week.
So if you've been keeping an eye on that, or if you think you might like to receive a once a quarter mailing of books and bookish stuff from Book Riot, you can search the BKR02 hashtag on Twitter and YouTube and see what people have been getting from us in those boxes. We haven't revealed it on site yet, but there's plenty of them out
plenty
in the world.
Plenty of spoilers
now.
You can go find.
And you can sign up at quarterly.co/products.
And you know, someone said something about it, someone who had got one that we're going to have to steal. Oh, we can credit them. They said
Book
it's
Nerd Christmas every day.
No. Well, that's good too, but it's not every day.
Every quarter.
It's like a care package for your book loving soul. I mean, that is good.
I love that.
Yeah, it made me just buy 5 of them just right now.
I know. One of our longtime readers, Steph O'Terry, said it was like Book Nerd Christmas once a quarter.
Okay.
Which
we can use
I
them
love
both.
That.
Like a bunch of books. We need 7 or 8.
I am totally not above stealing the nice things that people say about this project. So that's us, and that's our show.
All right. Thanks so much. I'll talk to you guys next week.
Bye.